Welcome back to another episode of the End of Time podcast. My next guest is David Thomas, the Conservative parliamentary candidate for Norwich South, Clive Lewis's future competitor at the next general election. In this episode, we talk about unlocking Norwich's potential, the role and the future of the Conservative Party in national and local politics, and the role that government plays in promoting and encouraging education across the country. There are two questions I want you to consider when listening to this podcast. The first question is, has this podcast changed your mind on the future of conservatism in Norwich? And the second one is, would you vote for the Conservatives? So I'm going to start off a bit differently how I usually do podcasts. I'm going to start off with a quote, which I quite enjoyed. Politics is not a game, but rather an earnest business. Mm. So that's Sir Winston Churchill. So that the first question that comes to mind is, what does duty and public service mean to you?
It's a really good question. And I think it's one of those questions that's hard to articulate, right? Mm-hmm. Hard to put into words what the thing is that makes you get out of bed in the morning and decide you want to do something that's not about yourself. But it's common, right? I think lots of people have that. Lots of people go into careers where they want to do things for other people because there's just something, I think, in the human soul that makes you care about other people beyond yourself. And I think Winston Churchill on that quotation is right. Politics is not a game. I think it's all too easy for it to become like one, either because you're in the Westminster bubble or in a student politics bubble or whatever the particular bubble is, right? When you get sucked into a particular competition, it descends really quickly into, you know, I like my team and I don't like the other team or whatever. But at the end of the day, people who go into politics, and I think this is true across parties and across colours, right? You go into politics because you believe that it is possible to make a difference for some people along some way that you care about. Nobody goes out and knocks on doors in the freezing cold or in the rain on a Saturday morning for a game. People at least start doing that because they want to make something, make some difference for other people. And mine started from education, right? My career was as a teacher and as a head teacher, and that sucked me into thinking not just about people's learning, but about the entirety of their lives. And when you are working with 1,100 young people who you care a huge amount about, you start asking questions about how to carry on improving their life, right? You become a head teacher, you're thinking about the life that you want for your children when they grow up and become adults. Mm. You're thinking ahead what the next 40, 50, 60 years hold for them. And when you start to ask yourself questions like that, it starts to go beyond just, you know, maths, which is something that I care a lot about. But it starts to go beyond that and starts to go into the kind of country they're going to live in and what that's going to look like. And if you believe it should be better, at some point you have to ask yourself if you're willing to make it so. And I think there are plenty of people in the world who answer, yeah, I want to do something about that.
Do you think now, especially in the rise of social media and very, very short attention spans, do you think that a claiming or kind of climbing onto a higher purpose, something bigger than yourself, is becoming a lot more rare and a lot more difficult to kind of possess or get involved with? Does that make sense?
Ooh, I don't know. I'm really wary. So I think this is true of all people in the world, right? But I like to think of myself as still young. And I'm really wary that I've started in the last couple of years to say things like, you know, people these days. And I always get worried that when you start saying things like people these days, you're becoming some sort of terrible old person. And I think that for all of time, people have started to think that the next generation and the modern age is descending into some sort of terrible moral degeneracy. And that's been the case since, you know, the ancient Greeks and probably since before. That was probably just the first examples of it we have. So I'm always a bit wary of suggesting that the modern age is becoming this terrible place where the youth are degenerate.
But in your experience as a head teacher and as being in education, have you noticed any changes in behavior, especially in the context of the pandemic, that there's been significant behavioral and societal changes quite had some negative impacts.
There's definitely been some negative impacts to the pandemic. And on behaviour and social media, it's clearly changing things. But I think what it's doing is emphasising things that were there before. So I don't think it's fundamentally changed human nature. I think it has allowed some negative elements of human nature to maybe become more prominent, right? So if you want to bully somebody, it is much easier to bully somebody in the age of social media than it was before. Humans have always bullied each other. There have always been that element of human character where we take pleasure in doing nasty things to other people. And that's why we've evolved societies and all sorts of ways of controlling that impulse in the people where it emerges, mm-hmm. right? And it's just so that the tools that we have around us now make it much easier to do that. And when you do it, it inflicts more harm. So that's definitely the case. I don't think that social media has meant that sort of people can't care about bigger causes or anything anymore. I mean, I think that the age of young people that we have now are at least as, if not more, switched on to bigger causes and thinking about other people than they were before. And what makes me worry about social media is maybe some of the other impacts on them and their well-being. I think it's very difficult to escape the correlation, and many people would argue causation, between the rise of social media and what's going on with people's mental health and their well-being. And that's definitely associated with things like how easy it is to make somebody's life unpleasant. And I think growing up in an age of social media is definitely more difficult than it was in an age before social media. I'm very lucky. I think I was one of the last last people to go through school without any social media. We got Facebook at the end of sixth form. I remember Facebook being rolled out to us and us being able to get it at the end of year 13. And I think I was really lucky to not have had that through school. But I don't think it made me care more about the world than children going through school right now.
I see. And you have talked about your experience in education as being as a headmaster. What motivated you to get involved in becoming a headmaster and to getting involved in education? Because as you said, it affects people for their entire lives. Education is the foundation of which most of society is built on. So what motivated you to get involved in such an important institution?
So when I was 11 in my primary school, I was studying for the level 6 SATs papers, which probably means nothing to anyone who's listening to this. It was a sort of extension paper on the end of the primary school exams.
I remember.
There we go, level 6 papers. I forget when they got levels got phased out, but no, clearly actually you do remember them, right? So level 6 papers. So there was a group of 5 or 6 of us who were studying for the level 6 maths papers. And we were all sort of about as clever as each other and good friends and so on. And the head teacher at our primary school told our parents that they should take us to the private school entrance exams and see if we could get scholarships because he thought that would be in our best interest. And so he suggested that to our parents. And my parents took me along and I got a scholarship at an independent school and I went to this lovely fancy school with fancy uniform, the sort of classic ugly colour schemes that one associates with British independent schools. And I had a great time. I was phenomenally lucky, had a brilliant education and ended up going off to university. And I remember being in sixth form. Knowing that I had my university place, I was a school prefect in my fancy blazer and my fancy school, walking down the big staircase. And at the bottom of the staircase, our school library was being refurbished. And the contractors who were doing the decorating in the library were walking in. And at the back of the sort of trail of contractors was a person about my age who was there carrying the paint tins. So he wasn't yet up to being able to paint the shelves, but he was carrying the paint tins in for these people. And it was one of my friends from my year 6 extension class.
Wow.
Who wasn't in education anymore and was carrying the paint tins for the contractors. And he was exactly as intelligent as me. There was no reason for our paths to have diverged as much as they did. But my parents were free on a Saturday morning when I was 10. And his parents weren't free on a Saturday morning when he was 10. And our lives have gone in very, very, very different directions in the following 7 years. And it felt to me wrong that something as small as your parents' diary on a Saturday morning when you are 10 should be able to lead to your paths being in such a different place when you're 17, and presumably very different paths that go on after that. And that didn't make me want to become a teacher. It wasn't a moment where I suddenly went, oh gosh, and now I'm going to be a teacher. Right? It would be romantic and lovely if the story were that, but it wasn't. I thought that being a teacher would be awful. And I didn't want to do it at all. But it made me care a lot about education. And it made me care a lot about how we create a society where your parents' diary on a Saturday morning when you're 10 doesn't determine your life outcomes.
Going off that, what role do you think government should have then in the regulation and the promotion of education? Should they have a say in the curriculum and in the content that you're learning, or should it be a completely independent kind of institution?
So I really strongly think government has to have a very big role in education. So I'll say that in two ways. One is making sure that everyone does have an education. Your second point about content, which is something that people dispute and argue about a lot. So I think the whole point of a government is to make sure that there is equal opportunity for children who are being born into a country, and that everyone has an opportunity to go off and build a life that they can be proud of. And for different people, that will look different because people want different futures for themselves. But government is there to make sure that whatever family you're born into, in whatever circumstances, you've got a shot at building the sort of life that you want for yourself. And the only way that can happen is by government ensuring access to education, because otherwise there will be families that have resource and families that don't have resource. And that will lead into children who get a great quality education and children who don't. And so I absolutely think it's the duty of the state to make sure that every child goes out into adulthood having opportunity. Mm-hmm. And the way you do that is education. You asked about content, right? So there are plenty of people who have the argument that kind of there should be some sort of independent determination of what people study in schools and it shouldn't be up to government. And I get where that comes from. I have some sympathy with where that comes from, but I think it's wrong. And I think it's wrong because there is nothing more political than what you choose to teach children at school. And there is nothing more contested than that. And we have a way in this country of making decisions where stuff is highly contested. And that way is elections and democracy. And I don't think there is any other route to legitimacy of determining what you teach in a school. I think the only route to legitimacy of deciding what you teach a nation's children, right, which is a hugely contested and important thing to do, is democracy. I can't see any other acceptable way of doing it.
Is that, that's purely on a national level, or should it be devolved to local communities, regions, like for example, Norfolk, and because every single community in every single region is different.
Yeah.
How to roll out a national policy and trying to cater education to people in London and to Newcastle, for example, they're completely different environments and different histories.
So again, I would say the structure by which you do that, I think, has to be a democratic one. And then I'll give you the you know, my view on what I think the democracy should choose. But I would accept the democracy choosing a different answer. I think it's important. So what does education do? One of the things education does is it makes sure that every single child growing up in the country has shared understanding of a certain set of things. And I think it is up for the democracy in a country to decide what it wants all children in that country to know. I think it's really important for a democratic process in a country to decide we want all children to know this bit of our history. Right? That sort of decision of what you think every child should know is, to me, a decision that has to be made by democratic means. And it's fine for them to decide we only want everyone to know this much stuff, you know, a small amount of stuff, or this much stuff, a huge amount of stuff. That's a democratic decision. Now, where would I draw the line? I would have quite a large amount of knowledge and understanding that I think should be shared across people, because I think part of the purpose of education is to take you out of what you would learn otherwise. Part of the education is to take you out of your comfort zone, take you out of the place you grow up, and to give you a broader perspective on the world that you might not get otherwise. So I would try and have quite a lot, actually, that's determined and that's shared, that becomes part of a kind of, national consciousness that you're inviting children into, rather than just keeping lots of different local consciousnesses, because I think that makes national unity and mobility and so on harder. But there's definitely space for more local things. I think children should grow up understanding the place that they're in. They should grow up understanding their local history. You know, do children growing up in Norwich understand that this used to be one of the most prosperous places in the country, in the heart of trade, you know, within England, and the heart of its wool trade and the heart of most of its wealth? Like, do they know that? Do they know, you know, that when you see all of these things in Norwich named strangers, do they know who they were? Do they know that they were the Dutch merchants and the importance of their investment, right? So there are lots of things like that where I think it is important to have an understanding of local history, but you also need a shared understanding of national history. Otherwise, who are we as a nation?
That is a big question, especially in the broader media narrative. I was talking about this topic with some classmates in Parliament yesterday. What is British identity? What is Englishness? And why has the concept of English devolution been so controversial or not really been possible? Because if you compare to Scotland, to Wales, and to Northern Ireland, they all have their very distinct identities. But I guess because England is so big, there's so many different identities. People from London can't necessarily relate to people up in Newcastle, for example. I would, and just to add on to that, a lot of people, when you talk to people, where are you from? You don't just say, oh, I'm from England. You say, okay, I'm from Hertfordshire. I'm from Newcastle. I'm from Manchester. There isn't that, from my understanding, there isn't that distinct Englishness of an identity.
It's interesting. You're right. If you go around, so I'm half English and half Welsh. And if you ask me where I'm from, I would say Bristol, because that's where I grew up. If you ask me what my nationality was, I would say British.
British, not
English. Yeah, but that's because I'm half English and half Welsh. Yeah. So I would say British and not English. If you asked my dad's family what their nationality was, they would say Welsh. Mm-hmm. I'm actually not sure what, if you ask my mum's family that is purely English, what they would say. There's definitely a difference. So I think part of it, of course, is the history, right? So the English identity is not defined by opposition to the Welsh and Scottish identities in the way that the history of Wales and Scotland means that part of their identity is defined by a bigger other, a bigger neighbour. And that sort of, that encourages a great strength of national identity, because that is part of how you hold on to who you are, because you feel under threat, right? And I think that's why lots of small countries have very, very strong national identities, because there is the threat of the bigger neighbour and you don't want to get absorbed. And of course, England doesn't have that. And so I think there's a security or a historical security that England has had that has meant that it hasn't had the sort of strength of labelling of identity in the way that maybe some other countries had. But I don't think that means that there's not an English identity. I think it means that it's not at the forefront in the same way. You don't shout about it in the same way. But if somebody comes from America for the first time and spends a month in England, they would definitely be able to point out to you that it is different. Yes. And they would be able to point at our idiosyncrasies, not just in terms of the particular things that we do, but in terms of our character. So I definitely think it's there.
I want to switch our attention and conversation to why you're here. Because you are the Conservative parliamentary candidate for Norwich South,
yeah.
And we've had Clive Lewis on the podcast, and so it's quite a very competitive seat, I would say, isn't it? And Norwich South specifically has historically not been a very conservative.
Not since the 80s.
So, yeah. What is your vision for Norwich South, and what do you hope to achieve if you were to be elected as a member of parliament?
So I'm going to go right back, if
go
I can.
It. Bring it.
So I was a head teacher in Norwich, right? I ran a secondary school in the centre of Norwich. And before that, I trained as a teacher in London. And the Social Mobility Commission does this index of all places in the country broken down by second tier local authorities. There's 324 of them. And I trained and taught and was a head of maths in Westminster, which was second out of 324 places in the country for social mobility. And I moved to Norwich to run Jane Austen because Norwich was 323rd out of 324 Ooh. Places in the country for social mobility. So perfect mirror image, right? Second top to second bottom. And the children of Norwich deserve better than being second bottom because Norwich is a place with huge potential, right? Norwich is an incredible city. It's got incredible history, incredible culture. It's a wonderful place to live. There's huge talent coming in, right? You and all of your friends and people listening to this podcast, but it is true, right? There are tens of thousands of people descend on Norwich to come here and learn, and they bring incredible talent with them. That talent grows as they're here. And we have that as an incredible resource to be able to build upon. We've got some great industrial clusters, some great research going on. All of the building blocks and ingredients for an incredibly prosperous place are here, and yet that prosperity has not emerged, right? So that's why my kids were second from bottom in the country in terms of their social mobility prospects. Now, that has been getting better, right? They were second from bottom because the educational outcomes in this city were not good enough. You know, your chance of passing your GCSEs if you're on free school meals, of going to a good or outstanding school if you're on free school meals, were really low. Your chance of going to a top third university were a third of the chance of going to top third university if you were growing up in Westminster, growing up in London. That stuff has shifted. Now, education in Norwich is much, much better. We've got some of the best schools in the country now. Sir Isaac Newton, the city centre, has been on sort of the Times top sixth forms in the country list, including all of the independent schools. You know, though we don't have lots of schools right at the bottom failing Ofsted anymore, educational outcomes are much, much better. So we've made a real difference for the children growing up in this city. And we've made a difference in some of the other things. We've dualled the A11. We've created the infrastructure that you need, or some of the infrastructure that you need to start building that prosperity here. But we need to do more. Like, you can't turn around and look at every single one of those indicators that put Norwich second bottom that moved me here and say we've made the progress we need to. So we have on education, but real wages aren't where they should be. The relationship between wages and house prices definitely aren't where they should be. And everyone listening to this should be bothered about that. And I'm sure you are. So there's much more that we need to do. Infrastructure to be able to create, you know, the prosperous industry and business that we need isn't there. We've got three quarters of a ring road, which is not a particularly useful proportion of a ring road to have. You know, you can't drive out in multiple directions from Norwich. You can only go down, you know, and you've got the A11 dualled, but that's not enough. I went from London to Liverpool on the train the other day, and it took me the same amount of time as it would take me to go from London to Norwich. So there's still much more to be done. And I believe we can do it. And I believe we can end up with the sort of future that when I look at my kids that I was teaching, I wanted them to have. I believe that we can create that in Norwich. And I want to be a part of trying to make that happen. And so I think my job, and the job of anyone who spends some of their time in politics and throws their hat into a ring, is to set out a vision that you believe is going to make people's lives better, and to argue and debate for that vision in the hope of trying to make it happen. And of course, the best possible outcome is that you get elected and you get to go and make some of that happen through being in power. But even if you don't, the force of your debate and your argument and trying to set out that vision and win people round to it. You know, we have a political system built on opposition because we think it is good to have people arguing for a different outcome and a better future than maybe the one that whoever happens to be in power has. And so my job is to set out that vision, ask people to come with me, make the debate, make the argument. And even if people don't, even people who don't want to, if I am setting that out and I am moving the debate, and I'm moving the central position more in the direction that I think is right for the people who are growing up here in this city, then that's a good thing.
Do you think, this may sound a bit controversial, but do you think Clive Lewis has done a good job representing Norwich South?
Look, I think that's for people to decide at the ballot box. I'm here because I like to think I could do a better one. I'm sure that if Clive were here, he would say that he's doing it because he thinks he would do a better job than I would. I mean, both of us are saying that we think we'll do a better job than each other. And that's sort of the whole point of it. But I like to think that I would be able to at least do things differently. And I'm putting myself forward so that people can make that decision.
How would you do things differently?
Look, I think I come at this with a particular set of experiences and a particular vision that are quite different to Clive's. And Clive is true to his vision. Like, he's a person who clearly has a strong set of principles and a strong set of morals. And I don't think anybody could argue that those don't guide him and he doesn't act by them. But we have very different outlooks on the world. I would follow my outlook just in the same way that he's followed his. And I think, and I do genuinely believe this, when I have conversations with people on the doorstep in Norwich, they are not telling me that their priorities are the priorities that Clive has. They're telling me that they're much closer to the priorities that I have. And so I would be acting much more on what I think are, from what I'm hearing when the conversations I have with people, the things that they care about and the priorities that drive them.
And that would be education, transport, and just unlocking Norwich's potential.
Yeah, I think that what we need to do is to create creating a city where we have the prosperity to be able to unlock all of these other things. Mm-hmm. And that is, as you say, that is a great education system, that is transport and infrastructure, that is welcoming business and investment, that is building houses, that is creating a place where every person who is coming here as a student or growing up here has the ability and option to stay here and live a great life if they want to. Also, the ability to, like, go somewhere else if they want to, right? We're not, like, trapping people here.
You come to Norwich, you can't leave.
They said that to me when I got here, and look, I'm still here. But you know, we do want everyone who comes to UEA to know that there is going to be an economy here with jobs that would support them and pay them a good wage, and that there will be houses that they can afford to live in nice places. And that there will be schools that will be good for their children to go to. And there'll be transport that mean that if they want to get back to their family and get out of Norfolk sometime, those transport links make that possible. That should be an offer that we can make to everybody who's coming here. And we can't do that at the moment. And I think you need somebody in Norwich who is advocating really hard for that, who believes in that vision to make it happen. And we know that good advocates can make that happen because we've seen examples of that through time. And we've only had the improvements we've had in Norwich because of MPs like Chloe Smith, who've worked really, really hard to be able to make some of those improvements. And, you know, that's what I'd like to try and do.
Chloe Smith, she's retiring at this election, right?
She is retiring. She's done 14 years as an MP for Norwich North.
14 years? Wow.
Yeah.
She's, I mean, because what is it? I have a part-time job at Norwich Airport, so she's directly, she's representing Norwich Airport. So we've tried to get her on a couple of times. Schedules just never lined up. But she seems very, very, very competent. I think she's got an honorary degree at UEA now, I think.
I think she's taking up, she's doing, I forget the details. She's doing something with UEA.
She's doing something.
Yeah, I think she, actually, I was in the Vice Chancellor's office this morning and she was also there, and I think.
True. And I think on campus it is somewhat gone out of hand. Just, I think there's also been a lack of guidance from the university.
Interesting.
So maybe this has come up in the meeting you've had with the Vice Chancellor, but there wasn't a lot of guidance in terms of what you're allowed to say, what flags you can put up. The simplicity of some of these things. You can't put up an Israeli flag, you can't put up a Palestinian flag. There's a lot of controversy and heat from that whole debate. And that has caused some controversy and unrest on campus, definitely sensed from different groups.
And I think it's hard for a university, genuinely hard for a university in this situation, right? Because everyone here is an adult.
Yeah.
And you are, like, you know, you're adults and you shouldn't be treated like children. And so there's a temptation to want to say, well, you know, people don't need guidance because people are adults. But there's also a reality that you're an institution and there's a social fabric to that and it matters.
And if you don't know the rules of the social fabric, the social contract that you have with the university and with other people with people across campus, how do you move forward? How do you communicate with one another if everybody's on edge?
And there's a place for rules And there's also a place just for education and people knowing about stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So there was a great study that was from the US, and we should always be wary about drawing comparisons between the UK and the US on these things. This professor, and I think it was just doing as a bit of interesting research, right? And they asked people whether you support the chant "from the river to the sea." Mm-hmm. And there was this big proportion of people who said yes. And then they said, "Do you know what it means? Can you, which river and which sea?" And of course, hardly anyone knows. Yes. And then they say, "Well, it's actually on a map. Or can I show you? Is this river and this sea? And here is what the map overlaid looks like." And then all of a sudden, people start sort of shifting and going, "Oh, well, I wasn't quite sure about that." And then you say, "Well, actually, you know, here is how people with different viewpoints interpret that, and this is what it means to them." And you just see people's views start to shift and shift and shift and shift and shift. And it just shows that, yes, sometimes there is a place for rules, and this probably is one of them, where there is a place for setting out what is taking, you know, what's not okay. But there's also a place for just trying to make sure people understand and understand what they're talking about. And you can't give a simple primer on the history of Israel and Palestine. But there are maybe some basic things that it would be helpful for everybody to understand that might help us move past some of the simplistic things and some of the things I think people say without understanding them.
And I think this, it also starts from a place when people start disagreeing with what history was, what actually happened in the region, you're just bound to start making accusations towards the other person, because yeah. I mean, you're just coming from a completely different place. History is written by the winners, right? That's a common phrase, but it's complicated.
Well, it's written by the people who have cultural influence afterwards, which are often the winners and sometimes not the winners. Mm. Anyway, I'm not sure if this is where you wanted to take it.
No, but I think that's the whole point of a podcast. It's a free flowing conversation. And I think that kind of leads on perfectly to, we'll talk a bit more about the Conservative Party and what the Conservatives actually believe and what do they value. So especially in the last few years, there's been a lot of infighting at the Conservative Party between the right, the One Nation Conservatives, and the more liberal, I'm making distinctions, but I think the more liberal kind of Conservatives keep battling out to see what is the Conservative vision, what is the Conservative vision for the country. I'm kind of curious to see where do you see yourself in terms of those parameters?
Well, I think all political parties do this. There's been plenty of infighting in all of them.
One's in government.
I definitely don't think that it's only the Conservative Party that disagree with each other. And I also, by the way, think the disagreement to a certain extent is healthy. It's a bit bizarre, but I've been reading a book on modern Catholic theology recently. And one of the things they talk about is the distinction between types of heretical view. And then within Catholicism, there is this distinction between...
Heresy.
How do you want to define heresy? Things that are against the doctrine of the church.
Okay.
They're like untruths, religious untruths. Mm-hmm. And there are sort of heresies that are what they call unnatural, which are, you know, as a result of sin and those deliberate bad things. And there are natural ones, which is even the saints would disagree, because at some point even the saints would disagree with each other about things, because there is no, you know, the truth has not been fully revealed. And people often say the Conservative Party is a broad church. And I think there's an analogy there. There are sort of natural heresies, maybe, or like natural disagreements where even a perfectly functioning political party would disagree about stuff. And I think that's a good part of the democratic process. And I think that politics is richer for it. But what you ask is, obviously, it is a broad church, and there are a bunch of different views about things. And you're also right that when you're in government, those differences tend to get magnified quite a lot, because people like to focus on them, because it's more interesting news to talk about what people are disagreeing than where they agree. But what's the core? I think the core of the Conservative Party and the core of conservatism is an idea that people make better decisions about their lives than governments do.
Okay.
And I think that everybody who is within the Conservative Party would share that view. And we would apply it in slightly different ways to different topics, and we would draw bounds about it slightly differently. All of us would. But we all fundamentally believe that you as a person are better placed to make a decision about your life than a bureaucrat somewhere in central government is.
I'm going to relay a quote to you by William Gladstone, former Prime Minister. Liberalism is the trust of the people tempered by prudence. Conservatism is the distrust of people tempered by fear. Do you agree with that assessment?
Well, I mean, William Gladstone was a liberal prime minister.
Yes.
So he was obviously drawing a distinction that was favourable in one direction rather than the other.
But is there an inch of truth in what William Gladstone has said?
No, I think it's the exact opposite. And look, that was that A, said by somebody with an obvious particular political bias, and B, said in a very different time. Mm-hmm. I think it's the exact opposite. I think conservatism is about a trust in people. Right, the whole point of conservatism is trusting in people to make better decisions than the government would. And the whole point of socialism, social democracy, whatever, is to say, no, that needs to be tempered. What we need is a state to come in and make decisions and constrain the decisions that individuals can. Now, of course, conservatives also believe in the rule of law and having some constraint to individual decision making. But we start off by saying, you know, the burden is upon the state to prove why it needs to intervene. But unless it can prove that it has to, individuals should be able to make the decisions for themselves. And socialism, social democracy starts on another end of the spectrum, which is saying, well, actually, like, the state's going to make some of these decisions and they'll make them better than people will.
I see. Do you think the Conservative Party in the last 13, 14 years has lived up to those ideals, especially in the context of we're the highest tax burden in history? Yes, we've had the pandemic, and Brexit as well has an impact on that. But do you think they've lived up to these values of the cross across their time in government?
I think any government would look back at the end of its time in office with hindsight and say there are things that they wish they'd done differently. And it would be dishonest, I think, of anybody in this government to pretend that there haven't been things that we would have done differently with the benefit of hindsight. Mm. Why is the tax burden where it is? Right, the tax burden is where it is because we have a state that has a public sector that has built into it the fact that it is going to become ever more expensive. Right, that is just a demographic fact. The way to temper that has to be for us to have an economy that is growing faster than the bill of more expensive things for people in terms of what the state is providing, and more people who are depending on them because we have an aging population. And so the number of working age people to every non-working age person is just continuing to decline. Mm-hmm. Right. So the only way of us not having a continually increasing tax burden is to be generating the economic growth to get out of that. And the Center for Policy Studies did their estimate on that recently, and they said that's about 2.9% a year is what we need to be able to keep up with the demographics. So I don't think that it's a point about principles that has led to the tax burden being where it is. I don't think that is a state versus individual choice, because those parameters haven't really moved very much. Now, I would like to see them in a different place to where they are, but I don't think they've really moved very much over the last 13 years. What has moved is just a continual demographic shift towards us having a state where it is going to be more and more expensive to keep up the social contract that people are expecting. So either you have to move the social contract, which is not what I'm advocating for, mm-hmm. or you have to generate a more prosperous economy that is able to fund that social contract, which is what I'm advocating for.
And you think Rishi Sunak is the person to be able to unlock and to fulfill and reduce the tax burden and kind of unlock Britain's potential?
Yeah, I think Rishi gets a bad press. I think that he is definitely much more fiscally conservative than people tend to think that he is. Because he was Chancellor during a pandemic, where I think he made decisions that were good decisions. I think introducing furlough, I think all of those things were good decisions. And of course, with hindsight of knowing how human behavior played out, there are going to be some things that we would have done differently. But actually, at the time, we really, we thought that was a good thing and we didn't know any better. And I do think he did a good job. And Rishi got a lot of stick for his conference slogan because it was like not a particularly catchy conference slogan, right? So the conference slogan was long-term decisions for a better future. And everyone on Twitter or X or whatever it's called these days was laughing at him and saying, oh, this is the least catchy slogan in all of political history. And there's something to that, right? Rishi Sunak is not a sort of catchy politician or prime minister.
Yeah, some have called him a very bad politician.
Right. But long-term decisions for a brighter future is 100% Rishi Sunak. Like, that is a man who is making decisions that he thinks are the right decisions on a 30 or 40 year time horizon. And plenty of people don't like him for that. Plenty of people will mock him for that. But he is making decisions that he thinks are right on a 30 to 40 year time horizon. And we spend enough of our time complaining that politicians only make decisions on a 6 week time horizon that I think we should be grateful that we've got someone who's making them on a 30 or 40 year time horizon.
And you believe that this, especially in the polls, I don't like to really quote polls, but it doesn't provide a very positive outlook for the Conservatives in the next election at this moment in time, obviously.
No, but if
I... Do you think that can change?
Yeah, well Keir Starmer and the Labour Party think it can change, right? Well, the leaks coming out from the shadow cabinet meeting the other week where they all got a lecture on, I think it was the 5 or 6 times in history where there has been a poll lead before an election of the size there is now, and the party that had that poll lead went on and lost. Right, so, you know, 2017 didn't quite turn out like that, but a very similar example, right? Huge poll lead for Theresa May, and within the 6 weeks coming up to the campaign, that completely narrowed. I think that there is clearly a frustration with the status quo in this country at the moment. There are clearly people who want something that is different. I'm not at all sure that what those people want is the Labour Party. When you look at polling and you start to dig underneath the surface numbers, it's a very fragile Labour lead. And there are a lot of people who are saying, well, right now I would vote Labour, but I don't really like any of them. Now, that is not a good thing for politics. It's not a good thing for democracy. And I don't want even the Conservative Party to win elections on people just not liking Labour. I want us to win elections because we're setting out a vision for a future that lists better lives to people and that people buy into it. But I do think that, you know, polls can change and public opinion can swing an awful lot.
So the Conservatives do stand a chance.
I think anyone stands a chance. If there's anything that we've learned about politics in the last sort of 8 to 10 years, it's don't make predictions.
Because they're always wrong.
Right? They're always wrong. You know, if you had stood around in 2015 and made predictions about what was going to happen over the next 10 years, yeah, None of us would have been right.
No.
Or approaching right. So if there's anything we've learned, it's like, don't assume that the obvious outcome is the one that's going to happen.
I think just to, you talked about people angry at the status quo, but isn't that the status quo that the Conservatives have created and maintained for the past 14 years? The current economic status quo, economic situation, social fabric, isn't that the primary responsibility of the government in charge for the past 14 years? Do you guys have the ultimate responsibility?
I absolutely do think that it's the role of governments to be able to stand up and own outcomes. Mm-hmm. And I think that we have to stand up and own some outcomes. Yeah. And it's not good enough to sort of say they're someone else's fault. And there is that human tendency. But the point of being a leader is to stand up and own some outcomes. And so we have got to own some outcomes about the status quo and take responsibility for them and take responsibility for having a plan to solve them. But I definitely don't believe that those outcomes are because of the Conservative Party, right? So we can take some responsibility for the circumstances that we find ourselves in and trying to fix them without believing that they were all our fault, right? Fault and responsibility are different things. Sorry, that sort of already starts to sound like a head teacher. And that's a lecture I've given on many occasions to someone who didn't want to be on the receiving end of it. But it's true, right? So the things that we are talking about are things that are common across an awful lot of countries similar to us. They're common across lots of the Western world. People are having exactly the same conversations about exactly the same problems, mm-hmm, because they are shared global problems and they are not unique to our country. Our job is to navigate those problems in the best possible way, right? It's like you can't blame the ship's captain for the weather. You can blame them for how you deal with it. But the ship's captain has to stand at the top of the ship and take responsibility for getting the ship through. And so I think that's where we are, right? There's some choppy waters. They're shared by all of the other ships, but we've still got to stand up on ours and take responsibility for getting it through.
The final question I have, I ask this to every single guest. I love saying it, but because every single person's answer is slightly different. But how would you like to be remembered?
Sounds like something that you know that I don't about my fate. how would I like to be remembered? I would like to be remembered, at least within the context of this campaign and what we're doing here, as helping people realize that there can be a future that is better than the one that maybe they're expecting, and that they have agency in bringing that about. That is not a thing that politicians do for them, although I think politicians have a role. They have agency in that. And it really can be better, right? You know, we've talked a little bit through some of this about the future and what does it look like, and what does it look like for your generation? And if anything, I would love to be remembered as somebody who maybe nudged a fraction of people listening to this podcast and people at UEA that conservatism and the centre-right of politics has something for them, and that you might be pretty irritated with a status quo right now, and you might be pretty irritated about the way that you think the future is heading, but actually that does not mean that there is no hope for you in the centre-right of politics, and that's not a place that has the greatest promise for you, because I think it does. And I get that people's views on politics sort of naturally change with age and all of those kind of things. But I would love to be somebody who just at least sowed a seed that said there can be a different and better and more prosperous future, and that might exist on the right of the centre. Because I think it does, genuinely think it does. And it comes back to what you asked me about what actually is conservatism, and the idea that the individual is going to be a better place to make decisions in the state. Like, I think that the natural direction is not necessarily great for my generation or yours. You know, we talked about demography and the cost of the welfare state and the social contract and the fact that's only going to go up. And that's going to be paid for by people who are working, which means you and me. But, you know, are you going to be able to buy a house? Is that going to happen? Are you going to be able to afford to put children in childcare? Like, is that going to be able to happen whilst you are paying, you know, the tax burden for generations beyond you, at the same time as we've built a planning structure that prevents you from building a house on land that you own, that prevents you from being able to look after a child for a neighbour if they so much as pay you a single pound because of the regulatory burden that we put on it? Like, there are a lot of things that are going to be very, very difficult unless we fix them. But they're really, really fixable. This isn't about building an entire new infrastructure, some kind of gigantic culture change. This really is about looking at what the challenges are in our country and empowering people as individuals to go and solve some of those problems in ways that they can, right? You should be able to go and build your house on land that you own. You should be able to offer a childcare at an affordable price for people around you without the regulatory burden becoming so much that it's impossible for you. There are lots and lots of things where I think the only answer is an answer on the centre-right that is going to change the outlook for my generation, but even more for your generation. And I think we've got a hugely prosperous future ahead of us if we can just do that, because this is a country still where if you come up with a great idea, like, you can turn that into something big, right? This is it's still a free country that has a huge amounts of benefits to it, where if you want to start that business, you want to make that invention, you want to make that change in the world, you can make it happen here. And there are lots of places in the world where you can't do that, but you can do that here, which is why we've got all of that potential. But we're going to need to do, there are a few things we're going to need to change. Mm-hmm. And I think that the only route to being able to change those things in a sustainable way for my generation, for your generation, is an answer that comes from conservatism.
And I know that that might not be the most popular view on campus right now, but if there was a thing that I could be remembered for, it's sowing that seed.
David, thank you so much for joining me on the End of Time podcast. I really, really enjoyed our conversation. I hope you did as well.
Yeah, I did. It was a pleasure.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Right. Great.
All right. Thank you, guys. And we'll see you guys in a bit.